For a long time, no one spoke. No one moved. R.J. Poteet, born in Virginia 56 years ago, had acquired certain characteristics in the cattle herding business which he was powerless to alter, and one was that his animals must be tended daily, honestly, and with maximum care. This included regular watering. Since the close of the war between the states, he had trailed one large consignment north each year, and sometimes two, for a total of 21 herds, some of huge dimension. And he had never lost even 2%, not to Indians, or bandits, or drought, or stampede, or shifty buyers. And it was unthinkable that he should vary his procedures now. He was going to water his steers. Earnshaw Rusk believed profoundly in whatever he dedicated himself to. When he saw that a new day was opening upon the once free range, he spurred its arrival. And perhaps most subtle of all, he had become infected with the Texas doctrine that a man's land was not only his castle, but also his salvation. In the long wait, no one fired, but all stood ready. Then the two leaders spoke. Rusk, still playing the role of general, said, "Did thee know, Poteet, that Ranger Rossiter is here to end this fighting? If thee shoots me, he'll hound thee to the ends of the earth." And Poteet snapped, "Rangers always side with the rich. I'm surprised a man of your principles would want their help. Friend Earnshaw, what would you do if you had 2,700 head of cattle within smelling distance of water, and none elsewhere to be found?" There was silence, when life and the values men fought for hung in the balance. It was prolonged, and in it Earnshaw Rusk dropped his pose of being a general and acknowledged that what he and Frank Yeager had been doing was wrong. It might represent the wave of the future, and perhaps it would prevail before the decade faded. But as things stood now, it was wrong. It was wrong to fence in a waterhole which had been used, as Poteet said, time out of mind. It was wrong to cut off public roads as if schoolteachers and children were of no concern. It was wrong to impose arbitrary new rules merely because one was strong enough to get a loan at the bank. And it was terribly wrong to abolish a neighbor's inherited rights simply because thee had Bob Warr and he didn't. "What would you do if the cattle were yours?" Poteet repeated, emphasizing the pronoun. Rusk had been trained to respect the moral implications of any problem, and since he had already conceded that his fencing in the waterhole was wrong, he must now correct that error. In a very low voice, as if speaking philosophically on a matter which did not involve him personally, he said, "If they were my cattle, I'd have to water them." And with a motion of his right arm, he indicated that Yeager and his men should withdraw. "We'll replace your fences," Poteet said, as his hands started cutting. "But if I were you, I'd leave them down." Rusk could never turn aside from a moral debate. "For a few years, Poteet, thee wins. But thee must know the old ways are dead. Soon we'll have fences everywhere." "More's the pity." "Thee will carry my wife's cattle on to Dodge?" "As always." "I'll go count them." "I'll do the countin'." Like many a politician, Senator Cobb, abetted by Petty Prue, was an outstanding success in Washington, but something less when he returned home to explain his behavior to his constituents. On his latest visit to Jefferson, he had barely reached his plantation when a group of irate voters drove up, headed by a jut-jawed Mr. Colquitt. "Senator," the man demanded, "why did you let 'em blast our Red River raft?" While he fumbled for an explanation, they dragged him from the parlor and down to the Lammermoor wharf, and what he saw came close to bringing tears to his eyes. For the stout wharf, which he and Cousin Reuben had built with such care back in 1850, now wasted away some 50 feet removed from the sparse water in which no boat of any size could function. "You allowed 'em to destroy the value of your land," Colquitt said, "and in town it's the same way. Our beautiful harbor, where the big boats came from New Orleans, all vanished." another man cried in anguished protest. Why didn't you stop 'em? Seeing the anger of his constituents, Cobb knew that their questions were vital, and that if he wanted to continue as a senator, he must give them a sensible answer. But he was not the man to hide behind platitudes or fatuous promises that could never be kept. He would give them an honest, harsh answer. Gentlemen, no one in Jefferson has lost more by the destruction of the raft than I have. Look at this dry hole. A way of life gone. But on the day that fellow in Sweden made TNT possible, he doomed our raft. For 100 years people have been talking about removing the raft, and they accomplished nothing. TNT comes along, and there goes our livelihood. It should have stayed that way, Colquitt said. And Cobb replied, With TNT, many valuable things are going to be changed. Well, what are you going to do about it? Do? About the raft? Nothing. Do you think Louisiana is going to let us rebuild it so that our Jefferson, population 831, can have a seaport? As soon as he had given this sharp answer, he knew he must become conciliatory, so he invited the men back into the parlor, where Petty Prue served tea and molasses cookies. Gentlemen, you asked me what I am going to do. Plenty, believe me. First, I'm going to surrender to TNT. It blew our raft right out of the Red River, and nothing will ever restore it. Second, I will lead the battle to get a railroad into this town, because once we do that, we'll get our cotton to New Orleans faster and better than before. Third, I'm going to make every improvement possible at Lammermoor, because even though we've lost our dock, we'll discover new ways to prosper. In Texas, that always happens. Mr. Colquitt, jaw still outthrust, growled, Can't you make Washington give us a railroad? I've tried to nudge them, but Washington says, We have to consider the whole nation, not just little Texas. Senator, I've learned one thing in life, Colquitt conceded. Whenever the United States government meddles in Texas affairs, Texas gets swindled. Cobb laughed, as did his wife, who said, Our experience has been the same, Mr. Colquitt. Texas is so big it has imperial problems. Congress is used to handling the little troubles of states like Vermont and Iowa. Texas staggers them. They have no comprehension of our needs. But how do you two people feel about the drop in value of your plantation? Who would buy it now, with no dock? Colquitt asked. It was Petty Prue who answered, vigorously. Of course the value has dropped, and sharply. But you watch. It'll grow back for some reason we can't even imagine right now. That's the rule in Texas. Change and adjustment and sorrow. But always the value of our land increases. Why don't we just leave the Union? Mr. Colquitt asked. He had grown up in South Carolina. That's been settled. But we can still divide into 5 separate states, that I'm sure of. Mr. Colquitt had been in Texas only 3 years, but already it was we. 2 more, and he would be a passionate devotee of all things Texan. We could divide, Senator Cobb granted, but I doubt we ever would. Why not? Which state would get the Alamo? He asked with a smile. If Texas had been powerless to halt the dynamiting of the Red River raft, it did finally end the Great Range War. A number of bills were proposed and enacted, putting an end to the killing. They worked this way, as a small farmer near Fort Garner, where the fighting had been heaviest, saw it. Anyone who cuts a fence anywhere, any time, he's to be arrested, fined, and thrown in jail for a long spell. Anyone found with a pair of cutters, on his person, in his house, in his wagon, he gets similar punishment. Any trail driver like R.J. Poteet, who forces his cattle onto land which has been fenced, is sent to jail for 1 to 5. But don't you think for 1 minute that the big owners who have fenced in public land get off scot-free, no siree. They will be asked politely to unfence land that contains traditional water supplies. They have to provide gates if they've fenced across public roads, and they must not ignore the customary rights of ordinary citizens. But they don't have to do any of these things right away. Government allows them grace periods up to 6 months, and if they haven't made the alterations by then, they'll be given warnings. When they've ignored such warnings, maybe 3 years, they'll be severely rebuked. In writing. Fines? Jail? For the big owners? You must be joking. Inexorably, the movements launched by Rusk to turn his village into a proper town continued, often in directions he had not anticipated. With the first four keystones in place—store, school, saloon, bank—he was free to turn his attention to the next three—churches, newspaper, railroad. With these, he met both success and failure. Banker Weatherby, also eager to see his town and his bank grow, was instrumental in solving the problem of the churches. "Earnshaw," he said one morning when Rusk came in to pay interest on his loan, "a town does better if it has a core of strong churches." "How do we attract them?" "We have several informal congregations in town right now. They'd be delighted to have free land. Then we'll ask the Fort Worth newspapers to announce that we'll give any recognized religion a free corner lot of its own choosing." Weatherby's advice was resoundingly apt, for when this news circulated through Texas, 8 different churches investigated, and 6 selected their sites and started building. Baptists chose first and nabbed the best spot in the heart of town. Methodists came second. The Presbyterians chose a quiet spot, and the Episcopalians not only selected on the edge of town, but also purchased an adjoining lot, because they said they liked lots of space for a generous building. The Church of Christ would be satisfied for the first dozen years with a small wooden building, and a group that called themselves Saviors of the Bible erected only a tent. This was one of the best trade-offs Rusk would make, because the churches brought stability. They encouraged settlers from older towns to move in, and they deposited their collections in the First National Bank of Fort Garner. When the bank had been in existence for some time, an official arrived from Washington to inform Weatherby that the title he had invented for his establishment could not be so loosely applied. "You can't go around calling just any old bank a national bank. Take that sign down." While the official was in town, he also listened to Rusk's complaint about the name of the place. "Can thee please inform the government that we want a better name? Fort Garner existed only a few years. It's a silly, militaristic name. Much more appropriate would be Larkin." Earnshaw made no headway with his plea, but it did serve as further inspiration for a campaign he would continue for 2 decades. Whenever he posted a letter, he asked the man in charge, "When does the name change take place?" And always the postmaster replied, "That's in the lap of the gods." The gods were either opposed to the change or forgetful, because the name stayed the same, and this so irritated Earnshaw that he finally wrote a letter to the president. "Mr. President, I have tried constantly to have the name of our post office changed from Fort Garner to Larkin, and have not even received the courtesy of a sensible reply. The state of Texas has so many post offices bearing the word Fort, it seems more like a military establishment than a civilian state. Fort Worth, Fort Davis, Fort Griffin, Fort Stockton, and Fort Garner, to name only a few. We would appreciate if you would instruct your Postmaster General to rename our town Larkin. Earnshaw Rusk." He received no reply. But quickly his attention was diverted to a matter of much graver significance than the choice of a name. A bright young man from Massachusetts with a Harvard degree, Charles Fordson, had for some time been moving through the West. A bright young man from Massachusetts with a Harvard degree, Charles Fordson, had for some time been moving through the West, with 2 mules, a wagon, and a cargo which had, since the days of Gutenberg, represented real progress. It was a hand-operated printing press with 10 trays of movable type, and it was seeking a home. As soon as Rusk learned of the young man's arrival, he cornered him, showed him the 5 remaining empty buildings, and assured him, "We need you, and you'll find no better prospect in all of Texas. Larkin, sure to become a metropolis. Join us and grow. And so this vital link was added to the tenuous chain of civilization. In 1868, the Larkin brothers had chosen this confluence for the site of their ranch. In 1869, the United States Army confirmed the wisdom of their choice. In 1879, Sutler Simpson thought that if he were to open a grocery here, he could make money. And before long, banker Weatherby thought the same. Now, in 1882, young Charles Fordson, with his peripatetic press, listens to Earnshaw's blandishments and decides that the newspaper just might succeed. But he names it the Larkin County Defender, for he fears that the town alone might not provide enough activity to justify his venture. During a quiet spell in the winter, Fordson attempted to distract attention from hard times by publishing a series of well-constructed articles combining news and editorial opinion. Random paragraphs indicate the thrust of his argument. In Larkin County, during the past 2 years, there have been 4 executions by gunfire on the streets of the county seat, and 10 in the outlying districts. Certainly, at least half the 14 victims deserved to die, and we applaud the public-spirited citizens who took charge of their punishment. But it would be difficult to claim that the other half died in accordance with any known principles of justice. They were murdered, and they should not have been. The only solution to this problem is a stricter code of law enforcement, by our officers, by our juries, and by our sentencing judges. This journal calls for an end to the lawlessness in Larkin County and in Texas generally. The articles evoked a response which editor Fordson had not anticipated. For although a few citizens, like the Baptist minister and 3 widows who had lost their husbands to gunfire, applauded the common sense of his arguments, the general consensus was that if some popinjay from Massachusetts is afeard of a little gunfire, he should skedaddle back to where he come from. The serious consequence of the articles came when the governor directed a fiery blast at the would-be reformer. His defense of Texas was reprinted throughout the state, bringing scorn upon Larkin County. Weak-willed, frightened newcomers to our great state have offered comment in the public press to the effect that Texas is a lawless place. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our lawmen are famed throughout the nation, our judges are models of propriety, and our citizens are noted for their willing obedience to whatever just laws our legislature passes. The governor's theories received a test in the case of the Parmentier brothers, sons of a law-abiding farmer. The boys, as so often happened in families, followed 2 radically different courses. The elder son, Daniel, did well in school, read for law in an Austin office, passed his bar examination before the local judge, and became one of the leading lights in Larkin County, where he married the daughter of a clergyman and was in the process of raising 4 fine children. His younger brother Cletus disliked school, hated teachers, and despised law officials. By the age of 18, he had been widely known as a bad 'un, a reputation that grew as years passed. At first, he merely terrorized people his own age, until boys and girls he had known would have nothing to do with him. Then he started stealing things, which his parents replaced. But finally, he launched into the perilous business of stealing horses and cattle, and that put him beyond the pale. As an outlaw, he participated in 2 killings, and following a raid into New Mexico, a price was placed on his head in that territory. But as usual, this was ignored in Texas. He became a shifty, quick-triggered idler who brought considerable ignominy to his otherwise respectable family, and he could find no woman willing to risk marriage with him. He consorted only with other petty outlaws, and it was widely predicted throughout the county that sooner or later young Cleet would have to be hanged by one sheriff's posse or another. Things were in this condition one bright spring day in 1883, when the growing town of Fort Garner heard the familiar sound of gunfire, and then the shout, "Parmentier has killed Judge Bates." People rushed into the streets to find the alarm correct. At high noon, on the main thoroughfare, a respectable judge, well, not too respectable, had been callously shot in the presence of not less than 20 witnesses, all of whom identified Parmentier as the killer. But it was not Cletus, the outlaw, who had done the killing. It was Daniel, the law-abiding lawyer. The judge was dead. Of that there could not be the slightest doubt, because 4 quick bullets had ripped his abdomen apart, and he lay bleeding in the middle of the street. Lawyer Parmentier walked steadily and without emotion to the sheriff's office, where he turned in his gun with the words, "A good deed done on a good day," a verdict in which the town concurred. Most towns in Texas had known such incidents, but this particular crime posed extraordinary problems for the editor of the Larkin County Defender. "Jackson," the young man said to his assistant as they discussed how to handle this case, "we have a problem." "I don't think so. Let me talk with the 24 people who saw the shooting." "The facts? We have no problem with them. The question is, how do we deal with them?" "We just say, lawyer Daniel Parmentier did what?" "Killed Judge Bates." We dare not say boldly, "Lawyer Parmentier killed Judge Bates." Sounds too blunt, too accusatory. The truth is, lawyer Parmentier, brother of the noted outlaw. Stop. No mention of the brother, we'd have both of them gunning for us. You may be right. So it's, lawyer Parmentier murders. Impossible to say that, Jackson. Murder implies guilt. How about, lawyer Parmentier shoots? I'm afraid of that on 2 counts. If we stress that he was a lawyer, it might be interpreted as our prejudicing the case, and we cannot use the word shoot. Sounds as if he intended to do it. My God, he walked up to him, if what I hear is true, spoke to him once, and pumped him full of lead. If that isn't shooting... You don't understand, Jackson. We must not print a single word that in any way impugns either the motives or the actions of 2 of our leading citizens. So Fordson and Jackson agonized over how to handle the biggest story of the year, and they decided that there was almost nothing they could say which would not infuriate either lawyer Parmentier on the one hand or the relatives of Judge Bates on the other. They could not point out that the lawyer had acted because a court case had gone against him, nor could they state what everybody in 2 counties knew, that Judge Bates was a drunken reprobate who took bribes on the side, as he had flagrantly done in the case which Parmentier had lost. In fact, there was almost nothing that the defender could say about this case except that it had happened, and even that simple statement posed the most delicate problems. And when it came time to draft the headline, young Fordson found himself right back at the beginning. Regrettable killing on Main Street had to be discarded for 3 reasons. To stress Main Street would imply that the sheriff had been delinquent. To use the word killing was simply too harsh, for as the governor himself had argued in his now famous letter, Texans do not go around killing people. And regrettable might prove most troublesome of all, because it implied that the killing was unjustified, and to say this could well bring lawyer Parmentier storming into the editorial offices bent on another killing that would be justified. One by one, the 2 newspapermen discarded the traditional headline words, deplorable, brutal, savage. They all had to go, until young Jackson wailed, "What can we say?" And Fordson remembered, there was this case in East Texas last year. They got away with calling it a fuss. You mean that Copperthwaite case? 3 men dead on Main Street within 5 feet of one another? They called that a fuss? In Texas you do, Fordson said. And then, in a stroke of genius, he dashed off a headline that might work. Unfortunate rencontre in Fort Garner. What in hell is a rencontre? Jackson asked, pronouncing the word in 3 syllables. It's a polite French way of saying that someone got shot in the gut. But I'm not too happy about the word unfortunate. The Parmentier people might take unkindly to that. We don't want to launch a feud. Fordson sighed, then said resignedly, No big headlines at all. No talks with any of the witnesses. Just something that happened on Main Street? And when that week's edition of The Defender appeared, readers scanned the front page in vain for any big handling of the story. On page 3, buried among notices of meetings and offerings of new goods in the store, appeared the inconspicuous story, Recontre in Fort Garner, with no adjectives, no gory details, and certainly no aspersions cast on either side. The editor was applauded for his good taste, and Daniel Parmentier actually bowed to him as they passed. The lawyer was not apprehended for the killing, because no one could be found in Fort Garner who had seen it, and the incoming judge, pleased to have had worthless Judge Bates removed from the bench so he could occupy it, held that because the killing occurred before he assumed jurisdiction, he could ignore it. Indeed, the Parmentier-Bates affair would have subsided like 100 other murders in these frontier areas had not the younger Parmentier, Cletus the Outlaw, suddenly roared back into town, shot the place up, and stolen a horse. The gunfire could be forgiven as an act of high spirits, but the stealing of a horse went so against the grain of Texas morality that a posse had to be organized immediately. "Men, we can't stand horse theft in this county." And 16 amateur lawmen were sworn in prior to setting out to run down the criminal. By a stroke of poor luck, the leader of the posse, not designated by law but by noisy acclaim, turned out to be the younger brother of dead Judge Bates, and he prosecuted the chase with such a vengeance that by nightfall they had come upon the renegade, struggling along with the stolen horse, which had gone lame. It was quite clear from the stories which circulated afterward that Cletus Parmentier had remained astride his incapable horse and had tried to surrender, thinking no doubt that his brother could somehow defend him against the charge of theft. But Anson Bates, as leader of the posse, would have none of that. What Anson done, one of the posse members explained to Daniel Parmentier later, was, he rode up to your brother and said, "We don't want none of your kind in jail," and he blasted him 6 times, right through the chest, him standing no further away than I am from you. When lawyer Parmentier heard this, he knew there was no possible response but for him to go shoot Anson Bates, which he did, as the latter came out of the barber shop. "Unarmed, without a call so he could defend himself," a Bates man explained to his clan. "This proud son of a bitch killed our second brother," and with that a general warfare erupted. The Bates gang killed 4 Parmentiers, but were never able to get lawyer Daniel, who moved quietly about the county, always armed. His people, fatal phrase, gunned down 5 Bates partisans. And before long the feud had spread, as such feuds always did, to the surrounding counties. For a while, Bateses and Parmentiers fell like leaves. But most of the dead did not bear these names. The typical victim was some unimportant man like an Ashton farming in Jack County, or a Lawson in Young who happened for some obscure reason to side with one party or the other. By the close of 1881, 17 people were dead in the Bates-Parmentier feud, and the former side vowed that the fighting would never stop until that sinful bastard Daniel Parmentier lies punctured from head to toe, eaten dust. In November, word of the Larkin County feud had reached the eastern newspapers, one of which pointed out that more white men had already died than had been lost in most of the Indian attacks in the area during the preceding decade. At that point, even the governor conceded that he must do something. And what he did was so alien to what an eastern governor might do that it too attracted considerable national attention. He summoned to his office in Austin a short, wiry, 61-year-old man, and told him, "Otto, this could well be the last assignment I'll ever ask you to take. You've earned retirement, but you're the best lawman we have. Go up there and slow those damned fools down." So Ranger Otto McNabb returned to his ranch at Fredericksburg, saddled up his best horse, loaded his mule with a tent, rations of food, and 1 small case of ammunition, and prepared to head north toward Larkin County. His wife, Francisca, now 54 years old, had often watched him make such preparations, always with apprehension, for she and Otto had attended many funerals of rangers who had lost their lives on similar lone wolf missions. But she did not try to dissuade him. "Take care, Otto. Do take care." He accepted the white linen duster she handed him, the 5th she had made during his years as a ranger, then kissed her goodbye. "Take care of the ranch. Be sure the boys watch things. He did not follow main roads, but used back trails through the lonely wastes of Llano, San Saba, Comanche, and Palo Pinto counties into Jack County, where he made quiet inquiries as to developments in the Larkin County feud. In an eating house where he was not known, a farmer said at table, "Gonna get worse over there." But another contradicted him. "It'll probably settle down. Friend told me the governor's sending in some ranger to stop the killin'." And the first man replied, "Well, the Bateses is calling in some reinforcements of their own." "What do you mean?" the optimistic man asked, and the farmer explained, "I'm told that one of the Bates cousins, Vidal, went to New Mexico to hire Rattlesnake Peavine to come east and get Lawyer Parmentier." This ominous news was greeted with silence, and then the second farmer said, professionally, "That's going to produce a flock of new killings," to which the first man agreed, "Sure is." They turned to McNabb. "You ever run across Peavine? Crippled left arm, but he only needs his right." "Haven't heard of him, but if he's a New Mexico gunman..." "He's a Texas gunman, ran across the border to escape hangin'." "Bad?" "The worst. The Bateses ain't doing Texas any favor by bringing him back, and they ain't doing Parmentier any good atoll." In the morning, Otto headed due west for Larkin County, knowing that Rattlesnake Peavine was approaching it headed east. Had someone from a superior vantage point been tracking the movements of McNabb on his western heading and Peavine on his eastern, he could have predicted that these two must collide somewhere near the town of Fort Garner, and he would have known that this would produce considerable wreckage, for McNabb was a man who never turned back or shied away from a difficult confrontation, while Peavine had acquired such mastery of guile and unexpected movement that after 20 years of continuous peril he was still known as one of the two or three most dangerous men in the West. Otto rode into town late one Thursday afternoon, a small, lone man, leading a carefully laden mule that never looked up. He entered by the dusty road from Jacksboro, came slowly, quietly down Main Street, and tied up at the rack in front of the saloon. Watchers noticed that he did not tie the mule, a sign that he had used this beast many times before. No one guessed that he was a ranger, for he bore not a single sign to indicate that. Inside the saloon, he occasioned little comment, and when he asked in a quiet voice, "Any place a man could stay?" they willingly told him of a farmer's widow who took in boarders. "Food any good?" "Best in town," the man assured him. But with a shrug which indicated that even that wasn't going to be too palatable. He ordered a beer, but drank little of it, then headed out the door, untying his horse, leading it by the bridle, his mule following behind. He ensconced himself in the home of Widow Holly, where he said his name was Jallo, which caused some discussion among his fellow boarders. "What kind of name is that?" "I've often wondered. Mother said it was German, but she was Irish." "Where are you from?"
"Galveston."
"Where are you heading?"
"Here."
"Looking for land?" He nodded, and the man offered advice, to which he listened carefully. He spent the next 5 days visiting land that might be for sale and listening to accounts of the region. He was much impressed by the Quaker Rusk, and especially by stories of how he had found his bride. But Rusk said firmly, "No land of mine for sale." As he went about, returning regularly to Mrs. Holly's for his noon and evening meals so as to catch the gossip, he reached two conclusions. The Bateses were a mean and ugly lot who had indeed sent to New Mexico to import a notorious killer. And Lawyer Parmentier was one of the most unpleasant men he had encountered in a long time. One night, after a stormy meeting with the man regarding a farm west of town, he muttered to himself, "If I ever saw a man who invites being killed, Daniel Parmentier's the one." The lawyer was sanctimonious, vengeful, hateful in his personal relations, and mortally afraid of being shot. He apparently felt that his only protection lay in eliminating the Bateses and those associated with them. And to accomplish this, he had instituted the worst kind of vigilante community, in which men went in fear of their brothers. On the sixth day, Otto rose as usual, shaved, donned his usual dress, breakfasted with the boarders, then went to the stables, where he mounted his horse, adjusted the two pistols at his waist, and rode to where the Bates brothers lived at the eastern end of town. Dismounting in one quick swing of his leg, he walked quietly but quickly into the Bates house with pistols drawn, and announced, "Sam and Ed, you're under arrest. Otto McNabb, Texas Ranger." Before the startled men could respond in any way, even to the lifting of a cup to throw it, he had shackles about their wrists and a rope uniting them. He walked them quickly to a stout tree at the edge of town, to which he bound them, warning that he would shoot them dead if they tried to escape. He then rode back into town, where he stalked into the law offices of Daniel Parmentier, arresting and securing him in the same way. Leading the lawyer into the street, he banged on the door of the sheriff's office and told him to fetch his deputy and follow immediately. When the sheriff started to ask questions, he snapped, "Otto McNabb, Texas Ranger." And on foot, he led Parmentier to the east edge of town, where he lashed him also to the big tree. When the sheriff arrived, McNabb told the prisoners and the crowd that had gathered, "Bateses, Parmentiers, people of Larkin County, the feud is over. The killing has ended. My name is Otto McNabb, Texas Ranger, and I am telling you that this town is at rest." Some cheers greeted this welcome promise. He then went to stand before the Bates brothers. "You've had grievances, I know, and you've responded to them. But enough's enough. We will stand for no more." Taking a long, sharp knife from his belt, he reached out and cut the two men free. Moving to Parmentier, he said, "Daniel, you felt you had to vindicate your brother Cletus, and you have. We all understand, but we can tolerate no more. The feud is over." And he cut his cords, too. But then Parmentier asked a sensible question. "What about Peavine? They've sent to New Mexico to bring him in to kill me and my folks." "I've been told that," McNabb said, never raising his voice. "And I shall go out now to warn Peavine not to enter this town. He is forbidden." With that, he turned to the sheriff. "Now the job's yours. Watch these men. Keep the peace." And he walked back to the center of town, where he recovered his horse, packed his mule once again, jammed his felt hat down upon his forehead, and rode out of town to intercept the rattlesnake. He rode 3 days toward the New Mexico border, and toward dusk on the last day saw figures on the horizon. Neither hurrying nor slowing down, he rode toward them. They turned out to be 3 soldiers on patrol from Fort Elliott, and as they camped under the stars, with the soldiers providing much better food than Otto could supply, they told him that they had crossed paths with 2 men named Bates and Peavine. "You say Bates and Peavine are still at Fort Elliott?" "They helped the captain hunt for deer for the mess." In the morning, the soldiers continued their patrol. McNabb headed for the distant fort, and at about noon he was rewarded by seeing 2 men coming eastward, each with 2 horses. Making sure that they must see him, he rode resolutely right at them. And at hailing distance he called out, "Peavine, Bates, this is Otto McNabb, Texas Ranger." With no guns showing, he went directly up to them and said, "I've been sent to Larkin County to stop the killing. 4 days ago I arrested your 2 nephews, Sam and Ed, and also lawyer Parmentier." "He's a killer," Bates growled. "I know he is, but so were your people, Bates, and now it's ended." Neither of the men responded to this, so McNabb said, "Rattlesnake, you're not to come into Larkin County. You're to turn around and head back for New Mexico. Bates, you can do as you wish." "He's coming with me," Bates said, and the one-armed man nodded. "If he steps foot in town, I shall arrest him, and if he resists, I'll shoot him." It was a moment of the most intense anxiety. The 2 men, watching McNabb's hands, realized that if they made an aggressive move, he could whip out his guns and kill one of them. But they also knew that the survivor could surely kill McNabb. Since it was likely that the ranger would aim at Peavine, Rattlesnake was careful not to make even the slightest false move. Showing no emotion, McNab said, "You can kill me, but you know the entire force of rangers will be on your neck tomorrow, and they'll never stop. They'll chase you to California, Peavine, but they'll get you." There was a very long silence, after which McNab said gently, "Now, why don't you two fellows split up? Rattlesnake, go home. Bates, ride back with me to a new kind of town where you can live in peace." He edged his horse away, to give the men a chance to talk between themselves. And for nearly half an hour they did, while he waited patiently, not dismounting and never taking his hands far from his guns, but moving close to his mule, whose load he kicked once or twice as if adjusting it. Finally, Peavine rode up to McNab. "I'm heading back." Otto nodded approvingly as the notorious Keller turned and started west. But before the man had gone even a few paces, he called, "If you try to come back, I'll kill you." Rattlesnake said nothing. By the end of December, 1883, Ranger Otto McNab had every reason to believe that he had quelled the feud, as he had been directed to do. But in the back of his mind he still suspected that the Rattlesnake might slither back into Fort Garner to complete the killing for which he had been hired. So McNab had the prudent thought of reporting in writing to the governor. Fort Garner, Larkin County, 27th of December, 1883. Excellency. Obedient to your orders, I came to this town, arrested the leaders of both parties to the Larkin County feud, and pacified them. They proved to be sensible men and tractable, and I expect no more trouble from them. However, there is a possibility that the hired killer, Rattlesnake Peavine, who is hiding in New Mexico, might sneak back to resume the killing, as he was at one time hired by the Bates to do this. I do not know whether to stay here or return to my family, and shall await your instructions. Otto McNab. The governor thought it safe to bring the ranger back, but 10 days after Otto rode out of Fort Garner, Peavine rode in. He headed straight for Lawyer Parmentier's office, where he kicked open a rear door and shot Parmentier in the back before the latter could reach for his gun. McNab was on his way home, well south of Palo Pinto County, riding quietly along his preferred back roads, when he stopped at the growing village of Lampasas and sought lodging with a farmer he had assisted years before when bandits threatened the area. "They could have used you up north," the farmer said. "What happened?" "Them Larkin County maniacs." "What did they do?" "Rattlesnake Peavine come into town and shot Daniel Parmentier in the back. All hell broke loose, and there must be a dozen dead." McNab said nothing. He ate his evening meal of hard-fried steak and brown gravy, accepted the bed the farmer provided out of gratitude for past favors, and left early next morning. He rode mournfully south, lost in defeat, heading not for home but for Austin, where he told the governor, "I've got to go get him." The governor, who had already accepted full blame for ordering McNab home, said, "Shoot that son of a bitch if you have to trail him to Alaska." And McNab replied, "You can depend on it."